Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
With supplies up and use down, supplies up mainly reflecting those higher imports. In use down, U.S. rice ending stocks were raised 1.6 million hundredweight to 43.5 million. That would be up 13.3 million hundredweight year over year.
World Ag Outlook Board Chair Dr. Mark Jackanowski going over the latest supply and demand estimates for rice.
Season average rice price was raised 60 cents per hundredweight. So right now it's at $18.40 per hundredweight. And that change this month was driven entirely by increase in the price estimate for short medium grain rice in California, which was raised $4 per hundredweight. Season average price U.S. at $18.40 per hundredweight. Year over year, that's down 80 cents per hundredweight.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Well, this was a big case near the end of 2023 where a federal court in Oklahoma ordered the removal of an entire wind energy development, a wind farm, so to speak, 150 megawatt development, and then set a trial for damages.
Roger McOwen is a tax law specialist at Washburn University, looking back at some of the biggest cases from 2023.
And now this whole problem has been ongoing since 2011, the longest running legal battle concerning wind energy in the U.S. And back in 2017, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit, of which Oklahoma is a part, said that the wind energy company's construction and development constituted mining, and therefore they needed to get a mining lease from a tribal mineral council because this was on tribal land in Oklahoma, and they failed to do so. And then it finally gets, 6 years later into another court to enforce that. And the development company still, the energy company still hadn't gotten that mining lease yet. And so the court entered permanent injunctive relief for the tribe and ordered ejectment of the wind turbine farm for a continuing trespass.
So what's this really mean? What does the wind company have to do now?
Well, they're going to have to tear down 84 towers spread across 8,400 acres of the Tallgrass Prairie in Oklahoma, and that included leased surface rights and underground lines and overhead transmission lines and all their meteorological towers and access roads. And it's probably going to cost them over $300 million to do this. And again, the basis for this was when the 10th Circuit back in 2017 said that their development and excavation work constituted mineral development, and that has to have a federally approved lease when you're developing minerals on tribal land, and they never got one. It's the Osage Nation there that owns the rights to the subsurface minerals that it bought from the Cherokee Nation back in the late 1800s under an act, the Osage Allotment Act. And those mineral rights include the oil, the natural gas, and the rocks that were mined and crushed when this energy company was developing the project. And so it's a really big deal. You can't just ignore these court orders, which the energy company did to their detriment.
Maybe a bigger question is, what does this mean for ag?
Well, I think it's broader. Yes, this is on agricultural land, and of course, these big wind energy projects do have a very broad footprint on agricultural land, but it's broader than that. I think the broad point here is that energy companies have to pay attention to the law. They have to pay attention to what the courts say. They have to pay attention to property law under state as well as federal law, and you can't just ignore that. And in fact, the court, in its order in the 23 case, said that the public interest in private entities abiding by the law and respecting government sovereignty and the decisions of the courts was paramount, and that their refusal to get a lease constituted interference with the sovereignty of the Osage Nation, and that was sufficient to constitute what the court said was irreparable or irreparable injury.
They might have ignored the court order, but you can't ignore the weather. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
The concern there were the back-to-back snowstorms, followed by the bitter cold. We did see temperatures dipping into the minus 20-degree range in some of those snow-affected areas. So the combination of snow followed by bitter cold, certainly a stressor for livestock, not a critical issue, but at least a short-term concern. It's tough to keep weight on those animals when they're shivering to stay warm. And so as warm weather returns later this week, that should become less of a concern as things get back to more normal cattle operations.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
There are a number of phenomena that are impacting agricultural land ownership and investment in this country. I want to highlight a couple of them.
Speaking in 2023 at a Farm Foundation forum, David Haight is Vice President of Programs at American Farmland Trust.
First is changes that are happening in the farming and ranching community, particularly change in intergenerational transfers of farm and ranches. According to the 2017 Census of Agriculture, there were four times more senior farmers in this country than young farmers, and 40% of those senior operators did not identify a young farmer being involved in the ownership and or management of their farm. This is significant because farms that are at a time of transfer are vulnerable for many of these families. They're going to have to look outside the family for that next generation. Certainly for some, this is a time when they can be lost to real estate development. And we're talking about hundreds of millions of acres. Senior farmers and landowners in this country own 370 million acres of agricultural land. So you could imagine in the next 20 years, there will literally be hundreds of millions of acres changing hands. At the same time, research from the United States Department of Agriculture, the American Farmland Trust, Farm Bureau, many others have identified barriers for beginning farmers and ranchers. One of the biggest being accessing land. It's hard to identify land that's available and is suited for the type of enterprise you might want to launch, being able to afford the price of land because of competition, or if leased land is available, being able to have lease terms that offer the type of security that a beginning farmer or rancher might need to be successful. So this transfer of farms from one generation to the next will literally reshape how hundreds of millions of acres are owned in this country. There's also a significant amount of land in this country that is owned by non-farmers and rented to farmers. The map that you see here is from the 2017 Census of Agriculture. It identifies the amount of rented land by county across the country. Overall, roughly 40% of the agricultural land in America is owned by non-farmers. This includes individuals like former farmers, family members of farmers, people that just bought land as individuals for different reasons, as well as institutional buyers. Certainly, it's not just the non-farmers that want to own land for and then rent it for agricultural purposes. There's also other non-farm buyers, people that want to own agricultural land and convert it to other uses. The American Farmland Trust released a report last year called Farms Under Threat 2040. It projects that roughly 18 million acres of agricultural land across this country is going to be fragmented, developed, paved over by 2040. This is not going to be spread equally around the country. It's particularly concentrated in states like Texas, North Carolina, Georgia, other parts of the Southeast. So this competition for land with other potential buyers is going to be a significant force that is going to be shaping land ownership patterns in the future.
David Haight with American Farmland Trust. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I will say, as a former U.S. trade representative who negotiated a lot of these agreements, we have fallen behind in terms of trade, and it's a conscious decision on our part.
Former U.S. trade representative and Ohio senator Rob Portman.
Not to engage in trade agreements for trade opening. And that's put us behind the rest of the world because they continue, our allies and countries like China, our adversaries, continued to make trade arrangements to lower the barriers to trade. And so I do think, I don't know if that's what he was getting at, but part of Bretton Woods was to have a system, was an international rules system. Some countries don't follow that, like China. I'm talking about the subsidization and the dumping earlier. But in general, what we have done as a country has been in a leadership role to encourage a rules-based system around the world for more trade. And our military does protect those trade routes, by the way. For people who don't think it's important for us to have a presence in Indo-Pacific, we basically keep, you know, the Sea of Japan open and the Sea of China open, and we keep the, you know, the straits open in the Middle East for oil. So I think the United States needs to re-engage in trade in a positive way, level playing field, understanding the good points that Cecilia made earlier about how they're uneven, you know, advantages and some disadvantages to certain groups. But we cannot step back from trade and allow the rest of the world to take advantage of these deficiencies when our economy will be weakened by that.
But what about trade and artificial intelligence?
I think it's already making a difference. I mean, I think it's already making a difference in industry, some more than others. And as you say, where the financial industry might benefit from more quickly, the manufacturing sector is catching up. A company shared with me that they're using AI for internal skills placement. So, you know, you've got a company of tens of thousands of people and you're trying to get the right person in the right job at the right time, and you've got an HR department to do that. AI gives you this enormous advantage to be able to, you know, come up with a database about all of you and figure out who should be where and when. You shouldn't be sitting there. You should be sitting over here. And that's incredibly efficient. And it's about helping people achieve their human potential. So I think it's already happening. And I think that's one reason you see this resilience in the economy that, frankly, has left a lot of economists scratching their head. I will say half the economists who were at this event last year, because I was there, you know, were very concerned about inflation, understandably, and talking about what was going to happen. And I don't think any of them would have said it wasn't more likely than not that we would be in a recession right now, or by now, that we would have experienced one. So I think it's already making a difference. Now, I do think it's a great example we talked about earlier, where the private sector, this wasn't government, this was the private sector, you know, being innovative. And we heard from some of those people the last couple of days. What I think we haven't talked about as much today is, you know, sort of the potential downsides and what is the role of government. And government has to be careful not to stifle this. And we're in an international competition. We talked about China earlier, but that's certainly true. But think about it in another way. If there's nobody sort of auditing it, it could both kind of go out of control and have, you know, negative impacts on our economy ultimately and on individuals. And think of the bias or the discrimination that could be in AI as an example. Speaking to a former dean here, maybe a current dean, soon to be a president of Brookings, in the application process. You know, schools are turning to AI. Somebody came up with this database, you know, the algorithm that's being used to determine whether it's going to be you or whether it's going to be you has got certain sort of built-in biases to it, right? Mm-hmm. And you have to be careful, I think, to have some way to audit that and to verify that this AI is working properly. And that's where Adina mentioned NIST. That's an organization at the Department of Commerce that I believe has the expertise to be able to handle this better than any other single organization. They don't have the funding. They don't have the expertise right now. And so my view is Congress should act to help NIST to be able to play part of that role.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Deals with reporting foreign bank accounts that exceed a certain threshold level.
Roger McCowan is a tax law specialist at Washburn University.
We can have income from foreign sources, and of course, we have to report that in the United States. But there's also another requirement out there that says that if I have a bank account outside the United States that at any point during the year has a balance exceeding $10,000 in a single business day, then because of the terrorist attack over 20 years ago, there's a new law that was put in place, and it dovetails into the Bank Secrecy Act, which actually goes back to 1970, which has other obligations that are imposed on financial institutions in the United States. But what this says is if I have a foreign bank account that has a balance at any point in time over $10,000, I have to report that to the IRS by filing a form with the Financial Crimes Network. It's known as FinCEN Form 114, or an FBAR form. And if I don't do that, I can be penalized rather substantially.
This is, again, more than just law. There's a case involved.
Yeah, that's right. We, in 2023, we had a case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and it involved a dual citizen of Romania and the United States who immigrated to the U.S. in 82, became a U.S. citizen, lived here until 1990, and then went back to Romania. Well, he's got various Romania investments that amount to over $70 million, and actually he had 272 foreign bank accounts that tripped the $10,000 level. And so since he's a dual citizen of the U.S., he's got to file an FBAR for those. And he didn't know about the requirement for the non-U.S. accounts until 2012, and he should have filed for 5 years, and he didn't do that. And when he did initially file the FBARs, he didn't accurately report all of his accounts. So IRS swoops in and said, well, the penalty for you is $2,720,000. We'll buy the fact that you claim that it was a non-willful violation, so we're not going to throw in the criminal penalties and you go to prison. But we're going to fine you $2.72 million. So what they did to come up with that fine was multiply the fine by the number of bank accounts that he had. Well, he argued that, no, the fine should be on a per form basis. I have to file one form per year to report all of my accounts, and I failed to do so for 5 years, and that's a $10,000 penalty per form times five. So $50,000 should be my penalty, not $2.72 million. Goes all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and in a very slim majority decision, he wins 5-4, and the penalty is computed on the FBAR filing, not on the account basis, on a form basis. So he still he wins. He still has to pay a fine, but it was only a $50,000 fine instead of $2.72 million.
And, of course, one of the first questions we ask here is, what's it mean for farmers and ranchers?
Well, in recent decades, we've had more and more farming operations, particularly larger operations, operate in countries in South America, such as Brazil or in Mexico or even in Canada. And if you establish a bank account in those areas and the balance exceeds $10,000 at any point in time, you have this requirement. You must file an FBAR. So if you're not aware of this, you need to talk to your tax professional about this. You don't want to get into the penalties under this.
So we turn from tax law over to the cold and Florida crops. Brad Rippey with USDA.
At this point, it looks like Florida's key winter agricultural areas should escape without any major freeze concerns as they are locked into a milder weather pattern. Yes, it's going to turn colder as the week progresses, but in at least from the central and southern part of the peninsula, temperatures there in Florida should remain above the freezing mark.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
When we think about farmland, and these are dollar amounts, these aren't acres. David talked a lot about acres. I'm going to talk a little bit about dollar amounts to start out.
At a recent Farm Foundation forum, Howard Halderman, president of Halderman Farm Management Services.
You can see I've got a map here of the United States. It's a little small, but these slides will be available, I believe, after the event if you want to dig in deeper to this. We break the country up into various regions, and there's $3.4 trillion in U.S. farm real estate. Of that, $1.9 trillion is cropland, that permanent and row. And out of that 1.9, you shrink that funnel down a little bit further. The 1.2 trillion is cropland in non-prohibited states. And you'd say, well, Howard, why is there a difference? Well, we represent absentee landowners and investment landowners who wish to acquire farmland. And if you look down the middle part of the country in the map, you'll see some states with white hatched lines. Those are states that today have some form of foreign ownership restriction. Sometimes it's foreign ownership foreign to the United States. Some of the restrictions are foreign to that state. So, for example, if you want to own land in the state of Missouri, I, as an individual living in Indiana, can do that. But my Indiana-based company or Indiana-based LLC cannot own land in the state of Missouri. That's state law. So every state has a little different variation to that has those hatch lines. But when we think about the investment universe, there's about $700 billion of cropland that's kind of locked away a little bit in those states that are prohibited to foreign ownership. And then you go down a little bit further. We look at water accessible cropland in the non-prohibited states. So where can we actually access water, either by natural rainfall or irrigation? That's about $1 trillion. And then out of that $1 trillion, there's only about $20 billion that sells each year. So I kind of thought this was helpful to put some metrics around when you think about farmland investment and what's actually available each and every year. One of the questions I've received throughout the winter, but I went back, looked at foreign ownership of U.S. farmland, because all winter I did these seminars on farmland values. And every single seminar I got the question, well, Howard, how much land do the Chinese own? There's 40 million acres of farmland. Now, this is forest land included, so I kind of break that down there. 40 million acres total owned by foreign to the United States entities. As a comparison, the state of Illinois has 37 million acres total. So it's significant, right? 50% roughly of that 40 million acres is forest land, timberland. So, okay, that's not necessarily surprising, I don't think. But that 40 million acres represents 3.1% of all farmland. All right, 3.1%, not as significant as what we might originally think. And out of that 3.1%, Chinese ownership is only 1% of the total foreign owned. So just that was one that came out in the study that I picked out in December 31 of 2021, the Chinese ownership. They didn't break it down by others. Certainly most of the foreign ownership here in the United States is going to be Western EU, Australian, South American. Those are the most of the landowners that we see that are foreign to the U.S.
At a Farm Foundation forum on foreign land ownership, Howard Halderman. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
There's a lot of reasons for optimism.
The former chair of the White House Council of Economic Advisors is Dr. Cecilia Rouse.
This economy looks like, you know, it's possible we will achieve this soft landing, softish landing that the Federal Reserve is trying to, is aiming for. But what I would argue is that I think what many people are anticipating is it's the last little bit may be more difficult to achieve than the first cooling of inflation. But on the whole, this has been a remarkably resilient economy.
As Americans, we like to hang our hat on capitalism, but she said, there's a downside.
This administration believes, and I believe this myself, I think, you know, we had a very lively discussion about this question. We have followed a very, not very, but we've had an open free trade economic policy. I'm an economist. I'm a PhD economist. Please don't make me give back my PhD over what I'm about to say. my profession has very much emphasized the benefits of economic efficiency. And so many of us would completely agree that open trade and a lot of technological advances, all of that is very good. It increases the size of the pie. But what it is a little much lighter on is equity. And some of us are very concerned that, and it's been documented from economist at MIT, David Autor, that, for example, the accession of China to the WTO and trade with China has had, we've all benefited in the lower prices, and we have so many of these. I'm not sure whether actually the last one is so valuable in my household, but we've benefited in terms of lower prices. But the costs have been not borne as equally, and there are parts of our country and there are parts of our population that have severely borne the cost. I have colleagues, Ann Case and Angus Deaton, who documented the deaths of despair. They have tied that to some of this unequal costs of this trade. And so through this industrial policy, if we can right some of that as well by trying to be strategic in where some of these investments are made, if we can bring jobs back or revitalize some communities or help those who've been left behind benefit more from this economic activity, that may help us have a healthier economy in the sense of there may be some cost in terms of pure economic efficiency, but if we have some gains in terms of equity, maybe that'll help with, the polarization that we're having in this country, and helping for having a more sustainable economy going forward. These are questions. I put myself in the category of industrial policy can go very wrong. I'm not going to argue that the public sector and all the government officials have all of the right information are going to get exactly right. But what I would argue is it's not obvious to me that doing everything decentralized and having government completely out of it has gotten it right either. And let's be very vigilant in how we try, which is what the president is doing. He's got these people who are really trying to ensure that implementation is going well. But let's try to learn from it so that we can learn the best of when is it appropriate for the government to do a little bit more direction through subsidies, through tax credits, or however it might be trying to nudge things in which direction? When does that go well? When does it not go well? When does the government need to get out of the way? But I think it's a moment to actually learn something so that we can have a society that is actually healthier going forward.
Former chair of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, Dr. Cecilia Rouse. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Of course, it's impossible now to know how much damage, if any, this current Arctic cold wave has done to winter wheat. A lot of that wheat was covered by a protective snow cover. However,
there is some modest concern for winter wheat across the northern high plains.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says the concerns are mainly for Montana, where there was very little snow cover at all, but some majorly low mercury readings.
Temperatures plummeting into the minus 30 to minus 50 degree range. There is certainly some concern for winter kill for that wheat, especially coming off a record warm December.
Rippey says there's also a little bit of worry about wheat in the southern wheat growing areas.
But for the core areas right across Kansas, number one production state, beautiful blanket of snow protecting the crop, and that should really help out as that eventually percolates into the soil as melting snow here, likely in a few weeks.
And in fact, Rippey says by this time next week, almost the whole country will be enjoying warmer than normal weather. Gary Crawford, Washington.